Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of the show. Glad to have you with us. My name is David Inge. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain is at the controls. And we're also pleased to have back here on the program Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She's on the faculty of the med school here in Urbana-Champaign. And every other month on a Monday, she is here and we talk about women's health. She comes prepared to talk about a few things that are new, perhaps some things that have been in the news. But then the idea is that for people who are listening, if you have questions that fall in her area of practice, you can give us a call. Whenever we have physicians on the program here, I try to remind people that we cannot diagnose over the telephone, but we do these shows to give you a place to start, so to be able to ask some basic questions, add to your health knowledge, and then, of course, if you have concerns there, you need to take that up with someone who can see you. But this certainly is a place you can start, and I know that Dr. Truppen would do her best to give you an answer to your questions. So if you want to call in and talk with her, you can do that by dialing one of two numbers. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. Now, we do also have a toll-free number, and that would work if it would be a long-distance call for you. That is 800-222-9455. Either one, whichever would be the one for you, go ahead and pick up the telephone and dial the number and give us a call. Well, welcome back. Glad to have you here.
Thank you. Good morning.
We already have somebody ready to go with a question, so
good.
We'll not make them wait. We'll go right to it. And this is a caller in Peoria, someone on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Yes, I wonder if you would please discuss having both rectocele and cystocele. What causes it, and at what point do they do surgery? And is that done with an incision? And also, is there any danger of just leaving it go as long as it isn't causing any problems? Thank you, and I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
If you think of the vagina as a tube, the bladder actually sits on the anterior portion, the top portion of the tube of the vagina, and our rectum sits at the bottom portion of our vagina, and it's actually a virtual space. So in actuality, most of us, the vagina is not really a tube. It's a collapsed flat structure, which is why they've redesigned the Pearl tampons to be a flat structure rather than the round. That's a little aside, having nothing to do with your question, of course. But as the tube becomes weakened over time, it has multiple layers. Of course, it's got the outside mucosal layer. It's got layers of gland cells. It's got an underlying layer of fascia, or the stronger connective tissue. You can think of fascia like a ligament. It's not quite as strong as a ligament that would be, say, in your knee joint or something like that. But it is a stronger substance, and then there's a muscular layer, and then there are some underlying layers as well as blood vessels. And the top portion of the vagina has actually the urethra and then the bladder. And there is a natural angle between the urethra and the bladder that it helps us be continent. And it's, if you think of the entire pelvic floor as a sling that this vaginal tube punctures through, the urethra is on the outer part of the sling and the bladder is on the inner part of the sling. So that when we cough, that sling kind of constricts, has a muscular constriction, so that we're closing off the urethra from the bladder and we are continent. Well, what can happen with the abnormality called a cystocele is that the top portion of the vagina is weakened, and some of that bladder then, as you get urine in your bladder, it'll pull down and create a bulging. It's actually a hernia is what this structure is, and it's a hernia that's contained of the bladder and the whatever fluid happens to be in your bladder at any given time. So that if we use our coughing analogy, what happens is that the sling now constricts something that's bulging through and may actually have some urine, so that it's actually physically constricting, kind of like if you had your mouth full of water and somebody pounded really hard on your cheeks, out comes this water, because you're not designed to be able to constrict it in. So that's what is wrong with having a cystocele. And in some cases, it causes enough bulging that the bulge is actually sitting on the outer parts of the vagina, so that some of the tissues that are designed to be on our inside are on the outside and can get irritated. In mild forms, really, there's nothing that actually needs to be done. As it gets more severe, the actual dangers, they're not so serious. It's more a question of problems with incontinence, problems with discomfort, problems with intercourse and discomfort with intercourse, problems with urinary tract infections, because the female urethra is short, so that bacteria that live in the outside portion of the urethra can track their way into the inside. Now, the rectocele is the equivalent disorder of the bottom part of the pelvic floor, and there's a bulging of the rectum, and yes, when stool comes down, bulges out, and some women get such weakening of those muscles that they can't quite empty that bulge without physically pressing down. And while that can be done, it's not particularly comfortable or healthy and probably does need repair. Now, there are devices called pessaries. They're made of latex rubber, although I think there's one company that you can find some of the shapes in polyurethane if you were allergic to latex. But there are latex devices that you can wear on a daily basis called pessaries that do correct some of the anatomic structure problems. And there have been a number of surgeries over years that are designed to correct these problems. And in past times, the corrections really involved taking the herniated fascia and sewing it back together to recreate the appropriate layer and recreate the tube instead of the bulge. But nowadays, we've realized that that's like repairing a stretched out rubber band. We can make it work, but it doesn't work very effectively, and failure rates were abysmal, even for the world-renowned surgeons. And what we have moved to is an era of using meshes. And there are small meshes just designed to correct women with incontinence and not really problems with cystocele. There are larger meshes to correct whole prolapses. There are new techniques to place the meshes so that they stay better. And what happens with these meshes is it's not just the mesh itself that provides the support. It's our own tissue growing in to the mesh. So the mesh acts as a framework, kind of like your trellis for your tomatoes. And it grows in and allows something that would be something flat on the ground to be an actual structure. And that's pretty much what happens with the mesh. So over months, actually, your own tissue reforms and regrows in the places that you need it. And the success rates have just been astounding. The negative is that these meshes have not been around for vaginal use for a long time. And so you'll find, if you jump on the internet, you'll find certain experts saying, hey, we're moving a little fast with these meshes. But on the other hand, many of these meshes have been used, say, in hernia repair for literally decades. So they've improved the meshes, so that specific mesh may not have been around for decades, but many of the techniques of using these meshes have been. So hopefully that's enough detail. I know our caller hung up, so she can't ask any follow-up questions. But
well, she can do that if she wants. I think she also was wondering about the surgery. Does this involve making a large incision?
Oh, right. Well, again, you know, it's so hard to tell you exactly. It depends on what your anatomic problem is and what sort of correction. But most of these new graft techniques involve incisions made in the vagina. And there's actually this one new product that I've been looking at that the incision is only 1 inch in the vagina. You can actually have the device, it's actually a form of mesh, placed under local, very few minutes, boom, you're done. Yeah. So it's been extraordinary because some of these surgeries were very, very detailed. And even when I was a resident, we were learning surgeries that were literally invented in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. I mean, they really had made no progress. And many of those surgeries are still being used in many locations today. But I think we're finally going to move on from that. And some of those surgeries were done from above with abdominal incisions. But for most cystocele and rectocele repairs, there are incisions made, but they're in the vagina.
And what sort of recovery times are you looking at?
Well, there's recovery and there's recovery. Depends on what you want to do. Heavy lifting, not for 6 to 8 weeks. But getting back to a desk job can be quite quick, within a few days.
Okay. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has a practice in our area. She also teaches at U of I College of Medicine. And every other month on a Monday, she is here and we talk about women's health. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, is there something in particular that you might like to talk about?
Well, there were a number of news items. One of the bigger news items that was in my field talked about dense breasts. And in the United States, when we send women for mammograms, they usually get a score. And it's called a BI-RADS score. And it might be a zero, which means incomplete, needs more studies. And I've talked about the New England Journal of Medicine article that talked that in the United States, we usually have about, if you participate in mammograms over a 10-year period of time, you have about a 1 in 3 chance of being called back for those follow-up studies. So that's one concern. But when we are scoring out a BI-RADS mammogram, it usually reports out as 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5 being highly suspicious for cancer, 1 being normal, 2 not so normal, but still recommend repeat in 1 year. 3 and 4 might be something that suggests a consultation. And some of what they are scoring is a term that has been called breast density. So how thick the glands are together, how thick the tissue it is, whether or not it's undergone some fibrocystic change. And we say that most women will have a little bit of fibrocystic change. So there was a recent study that specifically looked at the density on mammograms, and they compared women whose breasts were 75% or worse dense, so pretty much completely, to women under 10%. So we're not at the point yet where we can say, well, what if I only had 30% or 40%? We don't really know. They were comparing women under 10% to, so not dense breasts, normal, or very dense breasts. And in fact, they were able to show that very dense breasts on mammography was definitely a risk factor for breast cancer. And they tried to look at women who also were over the age of 55 and had breast density of greater than 50. And this was one of the most significant at-risk groups, meaning that as we get older, our breasts should get less dense. So if you are in a category as you get older and your breasts aren't getting less dense, you might be at much more risk of breast cancer than if your mammogram showed something else.
Mm-hmm. We're still, as far as screening for breast cancer, are still using a technology mostly that's been around for a while.
And X-ray.
And there are probably some, it may not be all that comfortable sometimes. There may be some cases, some women, where you actually don't get a very good reading that way and where you think, well, there might be something better. The other kinds of ways of doing the screening are maybe a little bit more expensive, that you use different kinds of technologies. Is there something that's on the horizon in terms of changes in what it is we use to do the screening, or are we still pretty much going to be looking at X-ray for the foreseeable future?
As near as I can tell, we're going to be looking at X-ray for the foreseeable future for the average person. Now, for somebody that actually has breast cancer in one breast, might be a reasonable patient to get an MRI of her breasts. If you've got $5,000, you can get an MRI of your breasts. But I have had trouble finding places that will only do an MRI of the breast and not also require you to get the mammogram. So if you want to use your money to skip the mammogram, that's not going to be very helpful, because they use a standard mammogram to help them figure out how to focus the MRI, because MRIs are only as good as the operator. They don't take the old-fashioned cameras where you looked in to press the button. They don't automatically focus. You have to set the tissue densities that you're looking at. It's very complicated. And also they have to learn to interpret what they find. So with the MRIs, the magnetic resonance imaging, it is magnetic, so it's not X-ray, very harmless, takes a while to accommodate the image, so you can't move patients through quite as quickly as you can move patients through a traditional mammogram. But then when you see that picture, they're making cuts in many, many, many layers. And in each layer, there's something for them to evaluate. Very, very, very difficult. Now, using ultrasound can also be helpful, extremely helpful in interpreting mammograms. Again, a hand-in-hand test for mammograms, but not necessarily a replacement for mammograms. And thermography, thermogram machines come and go. There was this T-scan machine. I think I talked about it. It could be more than 5 years ago. And I thought that it was going to win FDA approval. It was where they make a tiny electric shock. It would be like if you had, you know, walking on a carpet or something, yep, a little static electricity is what it feels like. I've had it done. And you get a tiny electric shot somewhere in your body. Of course, it's obvious they mostly use the hand. And then they quickly T-scan in differential places where they pick up the electricity as it travels through your whole body, including the breast, allowed them to target certain cancers. And I'm not really sure why it's not moved on as a test. But it was very, very easy, quick, painless. I guess not accurate, or we would have that as a reading. But basically, mammograms, every woman, age 40 and older, anybody with a family history of risk, most of those patients need to start at age 30. Anybody with a breast concern needs to get that mammogram sooner. Women worry about breast pain. Breast pain is uncomfortable. It can actually slow you down from your activities of daily living. We currently have no treatments of breast pain, and we're currently enrolling one group looking at women specifically who have very severe breast pain and specifically timed with their menstrual cycle, because that's one group of patients, and we think that we've hit on it's actually a nutritional supplement type of treatment that could treat these patients.
Okay. Well, we have someone else here who would like to talk with you. Someone in Aurora. This is our line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to say something briefly before I talked about breast cancer, which I have. I have moved and I haven't called like I used to, but I wanted to say that I am back, and it's great to be back with you people.
Well, it's good to hear from you. We were kind of wondering about when we have someone we get to know and then we don't hear from them, we always wonder what happened to them. So I'm glad that I hope that you're well.
I sent you a Christmas card, but it came back.
Oh, well, we appreciate the thought.
I will try again with the card. I wanted to say that I had breast cancer in 92. My sister died from it in 91. And I recently heard that they're finding less breast cancer, and I wondered why. What is attributed to that lessening of breast cancer?
Okay, when the National Cancer Institute looks at statistics, they're always a couple of years behind. So the recent reports of less breast cancer were from the year of 2003, and it's going to be extremely interesting because they came out with a report that said that that actually breast cancer rates right now, but they meant as of 2003, were down about 7% relative to the breast cancer rates from before. And there are over 200,000 new breast cancer cases in the United States reported each year. So 7%, we're not talking an insignificant number of women. Now, with those reports, if you dug into them a little bit more deeply, actually, and I don't have those figures committed to memory, as I'm not looking at them, but it's a topic I lecture on, but I apologize if I get it slightly wrong, but I think it was they were down only just a couple of percent in early 2002, and it jumped up by the second quarter of 2002 being down more percent. And I think in the first half of 2003, the breast cancer rates were down about 6%. In the last half of 2003, they were down about 9%. So when we tried to even look deeper, it looked like it was going to even be more dramatic. Now, they tagged that in time with the fact that many fewer women were using hormone replacement therapy. In the United Kingdom, in England, about 50% of all women at, around the year 2000 were using, menopausal women were using hormone replacement therapy. And in the United States, in that same time frame, about 35% of women were using hormone therapy. So not even the majority of women were using hormone therapy. And if you look at the numbers of things that cause breast cancer, there are many factors that have to do with breast cancer. So what I haven't seen is an article that says, okay, of these fewer reported cases, are these women women who truly gave up hormone therapy? Are these women who never started hormone therapy? Are these can anything else account for this? Maybe did all these women say, for instance, take hormones? Because in one branch of the Women's Health Initiative, the estrogen-only branch, actually they had some protection. So maybe it wasn't those that were discontinuing hormone. Maybe these are women with a hysterectomy that were actually using estrogen alone. So we don't know if this is going we know the numbers are correct. We don't know if the numbers are going to continue. That's first of all. We also don't know if this factor is going to be a risk factor or a risk marker. We just don't know what the reason is, but it's intriguing.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. It is good to hear from you again. We have some others here, and we'll continue. And I think next we'll talk with someone on a cell phone on our line number one. Hello.
Hi. Yeah. Hi. And I apologize. I'm getting a little feedback from my cell phone. I am a healthy 36-year-old woman who is concerned about birth control options and specifically using the pill. And I know that there continues to be more and more information that comes out about the safety of the pill using in women over the age of 35. And I'm happy to hang up and listen, but I was just wondering kind of what your research has been and what recommendations you would give women over the age of 35 who are looking for good birth control options.
All right, very good.
Excellent question. And of course, it's much better to sit down with your own healthcare provider. Now, when you're thinking about the birth control pill over the age of 35, there are two groups of women. One group that smokes over 14 cigarettes a day can't use the pill. Too risky with respect to strokes and heart attacks. The other group is pretty much everybody else. Now, there are lists, and if somebody wants to be scientific, the World Health Organization does a great job of laying out everything you need to know about risks and benefits of various contraceptive methods. And they usually do, they list things according to groups. So you have what our caller probably is referring to, a COC, which is combination oral contraceptive. And then you have a POP, a progesterone-only pill. You have an R, which is a ring that has both of those same hormones. And you have the P, which is a patch. They explain all this. But the combination pills, the rings, and the patches, they all have some sort of estrogen progesterone component. Now, most of the data has been for oral contraceptives. And what we have discovered is that they're extremely effective at preventing pregnancy. And usually that is one of the first concerns. You want to be effective at preventing pregnancy. And they also have tremendous numbers of non-contraceptive benefits. So as you add years of pill use, you're less likely to get ovarian cancer. You're less likely to get ovarian cysts. You're less likely to get a tubal pregnancy. You're less likely to have endometriosis. You're less likely to have pelvic inflammatory disease. Even if you did pick up an STD, now many women over the age of 36, not going to be getting a lot of new partners. They're not going to be in the highest risk group for the STDs. You're less likely to have PMS now and PMDD. Now, all the new research in pills has been towards fewer days off the pill. So the old 21 active pills, 7 days of inactive pills, we find is associated with a higher failure rate, higher rate of escape ovulation, higher rate of cysts, and probably is not as effective as a contraception option in terms of cycle control as these newer regimens like, and, you know, I know, you know, I try not to be too commercial, but that shortperiod.com. They do a good job with that information. And so that pill, the low estrogen 24-4, has now only 4 days with no pill use. We are working with a pill that actually has only 2 days with not pill use. So that allows you to still have a regular, very short cycle, as opposed to the Librel, which is about to come out. It's a one full year with no days off of the pill. And I was involved in that research study. And with that particular pill, we were able to get many women very happy, but you're going to see, like the choices of Seasonal and Seasonique, the other long cycle pills, one having 84 days on, 7 off, the other having 84 days on and only low dose of estrogen and the interval off. Those very long cycle pills do allow you to go a long time without your periods, but about 50% of all women will have breakthrough bleeding. So I still think the pill is an excellent choice. If you go to the PDR and read the package insert for birth control pills, there is no upper age limit. If you talk about the risks, any of the risks that you can talk about with birth control pills, the risks are so small for most healthy women that whether you take the pill for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, your risks aren't changing significantly because you're multiplying such a small number by a small number, so that many women can safely and healthily be on the birth control pill up into their early 50s. And about 50% of women age 55 even who are still having regular periods will still have ovulations. So the contraception is still not an insignificant factor, even as women get well beyond the age of, I think our caller gave us the age of 36 as our cutoff there. Mm-hmm. I know we usually talk about 35 and older as being older. But the Mirena IUD, which is a progesterone-only IUD, which cuts down on the menstrual periods, is an excellent choice for women. Mirena is approved for 5 years of use in the United States, so it's good long-term protection. Paragard IUD is approved for 10 years of use. Also, very user-friendly. Get that IUD popped in. You're basically done with your contraception for 10 years. Doesn't have as many non-contraceptive benefits as the birth control pill would have. But all the methods of contraception, even tubal ligations, are associated with a little bit lower rate of ovarian cancer, which is kind of interesting. And then the methods of tubal sterilization, the eSure coils that can be placed in the office under local, 6 to 10 minutes in an experienced operator, might take 15 to 20 if there's little kinks that they run into with the procedure. Scars into place, you have to get a check on it in 3 months. But I think that many, many more women are going to opt for the eSure rather than just a plain tubal ligation. And, of course, we still do have barrier methods, but they're much fussier as we get older. Probably the things where you have to make fewer health decisions is probably better. Yeah.
Well, some women might say, well, I appreciate the fact that there may be some demonstrated benefits using these hormonal methods, no matter what the method of administering it is, but who might say, well, you know, I'm still sort of uncomfortable with that.
With hormones.
With hormones. If you say, if I tell you that I will religiously use the method as instructed, if you pick something traditional, just like a diaphragm, what can you say about its effective?
Well, the initial failure rates are very, very, very high. What I would say to you is, hey, have you and your partner been using this successfully for more than 2 years? Then I'd say you're a good user and you're going to have success. The other issue that our caller didn't mention, that she had any specific health concerns, but huge health concern for women, is heavy menstrual cycles. Mm-hmm. And we do know that because the way the birth control pill has been designed, it is specifically designed that lining will build up a little bit less. And definitely it's even a treatment for heavy menstrual cycles, not just to take a regular period and make it less, which it does do. And in worldwide, in the United States, probably being placed on the birth control pill is pretty much you go into a doctor's office and they don't find anything too wrong, but your periods are too heavy. Maybe you're even becoming anemic. You will be offered a hormonal pill to control that, and maybe progesterone only. Most likely it'll be a combination. However, worldwide, the number one medicine for using this is transaminic acid. And for women using transaminic acid, they take it just when they have heavy menstrual periods. It's approved in about 60 or 70 countries. I think it's even over the counter in Sweden. And you only take it during your menstrual period. We don't know exactly physiologically how it works, but it works somehow by breaking up the clots that women have on heavy periods and allowing the blood vessels of the lining of the uterus to contract. And I am involved in some work on transaminic acid as well. The study that we're enrolling for that is a two-year study. We're having a little trouble finding people that want to participate in a study for a whole 2 years, but if you're a dedicated woman's health person, that's a good way to go. We also know that that there are ways of surgically removing the lining of the uterus, and there's tons of these ways. The most popular few years ago was the ThermoChoice balloon. Lots of facilities still use it. It's excellent. Basically, under general anesthesia or under local anesthesia, you have a balloon placed inside your uterus. It's filled up with hot water. And it, because of the temperature, it's, I think, 87 degrees centigrade. Because of the temperature of the water that is placed in the balloon, it's about an 8-minute treatment cycle, and it takes a little while for the water to heat up. And it burns out the lining of the uterus with very high success rates in preventing heavy periods. And now the device that many of us prefer is called a NovaSure. And it is a bipolar. It's a wand that uses radio frequency, I think, to generate bipolar energy, and it essentially burns out the lining of the uterus. It's not for women intending to have children in the future, but it's a 90-second treatment cycle, usually done under local anesthesia, again, in the office. So that is excellent. I think some facilities only have it available under general in hospitals, but, you know, so you might find some variation there. There's also one that just streams hot water in your uterus and one that actually freezes the lining of the uterus. It's a procedure called cryoablation. So actually treatments of heavy menstrual bleeding with things beyond birth control pills, and usually these conditions are in women over the age of 36. So there are many options, but not all the options cover your contraception option as well as your treatment goals. So it's something you pretty much need to talk to your individual provider about to get in the right direction.
Okay. Well, again, I hope that helps the caller. We have someone else and would welcome others. Dr. Suzanne Truppen is our guest. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has a practice in our area. She teaches at U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign every other month. On a Monday, she is here on the program, and we take questions about women's health. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller here where we are, Champaign County. That's next, line two. Hello.
Hi. I called in with a question about papillomavirus, but last month I called in about contraception, and I was wanting to point out that it seems that at least Carl here doesn't use a non-hormonal IUD for possibility of people that may have sensitivities, allergic or otherwise. So I don't know how hard it is to overturn that decision, but that's not what I actually was planning on calling about. It's the overwhelming amount of information in the last 5 minutes while I've been waiting on the phone, so
I'm a little
overwhelmed. But back to the papilloma, there was some discussion about whether it's really the right kind of expense for medical health, in the sense that we have more money spent on public health and. But we don't have an integrated mental health, much less health system in this country. So it seems to me that we should be also calling for that kind of reform as well. It seems to me that, you know, this is a very expensive vaccination for something that's going to be onset maybe in 40 years. So, you know, that one could expect that maybe research would do something in the meantime as well.
Not all cases of cervical cancer will occur in 40-year-olds. I myself, in my own practice, have diagnosed it in a 19-year-old, and I think a 25-year-old. Well, but it's still the burden of precancerous disease for our young people is just immense. It's an excellent product, and we can't always argue dollars and cents because there's so much that goes into the dollars and cents. But in terms of the HPV vaccine, I really can't be anything but 100% behind it. In terms of the fact that we need other things addressed in our healthcare system, oh, absolutely.
Okay. I didn't want to digress, but there was sort of a bizarre letter in the paper this past weekend in the Gazette about some, and it seems like to me it's kind of an orchestrated attack, where the person was talking about aluminum in the vaccine. It's sort of reminiscent of the concerns in the past about the mercury and other vaccinations and all that business. And I think it's pretty much probably...
The adjuvant in the HPV vaccine is the same adjuvant that we use in the hepatitis B vaccines and other vaccines. Merck is a huge vaccine company, and the basic stuff that they make the vaccine out of is the same basic stuff as in lots of vaccines that have been successfully used and implemented in vaccine prevented programs. And probably no one substance is going to be healthy for every human on the face of the earth. But generally, this vaccine is extraordinarily safe.
Yeah. So there's a couple of things going on at the same time is what I was trying to get at.
Oh, okay.
Because I don't say categorically this is a bad thing. I just wish we had a healthcare system that would evaluate things a little more consistently as to what the long-range impact is. But again, there was this bizarre letter about it being dangerous in some way along the line, and it seems to me it seems like it's part of this orchestrated campaign. I guess that's what I wanted to bring up. So thanks very much.
Thanks. I'll take a look at the letter. I must have missed it.
I do think this is one of the things that if you hadn't brought it up, I thought we should at least touch on. We certainly have talked in the past about this vaccine that's now available for some forms of the human papillomavirus, and it's the idea is that if you give this to girls before they become sexually active, then it will reduce their chances of developing cervical cancer. I think
also
the last
will significantly reduce their chances of developing cervical dysplasia, vaginal cancers, vulvar dysplasia, vulvar cancers. It will also reduce their rate of abnormal pap smears and reduce their rate of genital warts.
Okay, so all of the things.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the reason that I was bringing it up because I think that the last time we talked, there hadn't yet been the various physician groups, the pediatricians, the OBGYNs, the people who deal with cancer, I'm not sure that they actually had made recommendations yet about who should have it. Now, I think that they have, although I'm not sure that there's agreement about particularly the issue of at what age do you recommend that a girl should get the shot? And then there's another question about, okay, so we're going to start to give it to girls who are not yet sexually active. What about women who are, say, over 25? Do we give it to them?
Well, the vaccine has been approved by our FDA for girls between the ages of 9 and women up to the age of 26. So likely, if you're going to have a vaccine that's covered, it's going to be in that. My patients that are above the age of 26, I am trying to seriously talk to them about what their risks and benefits might be of the vaccine. With the understanding that the series is probably going to be $550 if they were paying cash. But for some of these patients, I think it's a good spend for their $550. I can tell you that the vaccine is approved for boys. I was thinking that maybe I missed my letter. I did write a letter to the editor, but I don't know if it's made it in about the proposed making it a state law for girls to get this vaccine mm-hmm. prior to sixth grade. And I said, well, you know, in Australia, they do vaccinate boys, and there is a lot of sensibleness behind vaccinating the people, the girls that are having sex with and getting it passed from. And that, you know, I think it's all good if we can pay for as many vaccines as possible, but maybe in terms of a law, you know, I don't know that we're really ready to not include boys and so forth and so on. But it's a big topic. I think the Gardasil.com website, the Merck.com website does a fabulous job of answering questions. And I think that the materials you can download from them would be very helpful.
So, in just to make this clear in my mind, in Australia, they vaccinate both boys and girls,
they
or just boys?
They vaccinate boys and girls.
Both
boys and girls, okay. Sorry. Yes, in Australia, it has to do with their laws. They were submitted the same information about girls that we submitted to our FDA, to their equivalent board. I can't remember the name of it. I've heard it. But the way that I have been told is that the laws are such in Australia that you can't discriminate. There's no such thing as passing a law saying that it's okay to vaccinate only one sex and not the other. Mm. So it just kind of swept them in. And so they vaccinate boys and girls.
So now, is there a recommendation from American College OBGYN?
Well, you know, you were saying that, and I've read some things from the American College of OBGYN regarding it, and I can't remember their exact statement. I know the CDC recommends age 11 to 12 as the ideal time, and I don't know.
Okay. Well, I'm sure that people can find, if you got web access, I guess you can find that.
ACOG.org.
The one other thing, and the caller mentioned it, and I'm sure it's come up in our past discussions, one issue is that it's expensive. At this point now, what do you know about health plans? And
I think, the Health Alliance health plans jumped on it immediately. Many of my personal care health plan patients, they have that covered. Blue Cross plans, because I'm a private office, what we do is we try to pre-authorize. So we pre-authorize for you with your insurance company and let you know what's covered, what's not covered. They have it at McKinley, but their costs are very high. You essentially have to pay for it out of pocket at McKinley, but you can get it at our local University of Illinois Health Center as well.
All right. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. It's our monthly show on women's health, and our guest is Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She's here every other month on a Monday. We do these shows. We have another caller here who would like to talk with us. This is line one in Champaign.
Hello.
Hello. Yes.
I'd like to talk about my daughter who is having a hysterectomy. She's it's an abdominal incision for extensive fibroids. What should I expect in caring for her in the way of recovery?
Well, uterine fibroids come in many different sizes, and they come with sometimes associated medical problems. And some individuals are choosing to have oophorectomies, some aren't. So there are lots of individual considerations. And in terms of, for listeners who might not know, these fibroids are essentially benign muscle knots that can grow from little pea-sized specks all the way up to soccer ball kinds of size objects. And depending on the overall size of the uterus and the surgeon's experience, background, and techniques, some of these hysterectomies, if it in fact comes to that, can be performed vaginally. Some can be performed abdominally. Because the fibroids can be removed in pieces, sometimes the abdominal incisions are smaller. Sometimes they're relatively larger. Again, somewhat has to do with the physician themselves. Most patients will go in the morning of their surgery. Most patients will be released from the hospital for an abdominal hysterectomy on the second or the third day. Most patients are walking for exercise. Again, is this patient obese? Is this patient a smoker? Does this patient have diabetes or hypertension or any specifically medical concerns that would slow down their recovery? Walking usually is about the best. In terms of the incision itself, there are different ways that the incision can be closed. So for some people, they're getting staples. Those have to be usually removed in 4 to 5 days. For some people, they're getting stitches that dissolve, and that's a different consideration. Most physicians are a little bit shy about letting their patients get right behind a wheel because we're concerned with the amount of pain medicine, and the amount of pain medicine used is so variable. Many of us will have patients that take a couple of Tylenol when they get home from a hysterectomy. We're surprised, but it does happen. And other patients feel the need to have strong narcotics pretty much around the clock for the next week or two. So, I mean, it highly varies, and that pain medicine use will be one consideration in terms of driving. In terms of heavy lifting, most physicians will say after a major surgery they don't want their patients doing heavy lifting for 4 to 6 weeks. Most surgeons are not going to release people to go back to work till they're off their pain medicines, and depending on what your job requirements are. In the studies that we've done and what slows people's recovery down the most, it's anemia. So anything people can do to build up their blood count seems to be very, very important in terms of getting back on your feet.
What about stairs?
Well, we know that when you walk on stairs, you use your abdominal muscles a little bit more, and your abdominal muscles have been cut through and they're going to be sore. And so going upstairs is fine, coming downstairs is fine, but nobody's in good shape to run up and down the stairs a lot, and moving quickly can make people lightheaded, so they want assistance. But usually they get back to stairs fairly quickly.
Okay, I'm planning on staying with her for 3 weeks. Is that ample time?
Well, you know, what we do in our office is we have what's called a preoperative appointment, where we kind of go over the patient's specific case and things that may affect our patient's recovery time relative to average. But typical patients, healthy, motivated to get walking, and you know, pretty good weight, not big medical problems going into their hysterectomy, 3 weeks is a good amount of time that they can be on their own pretty good after that.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, very good. Thank you. We have certainly time for at least one call if somebody gets in pretty quick here. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Is there something else that you want to talk about?
Well, in one of the things that came across my email box this morning was looking at now, you know, for gynecologists, we've always been talking to patients about SBEs, our self breast exams, and now there's going to be a nationwide push for SSEs, and that is a self skin examination. Of course, some of our skin is in places we can't see very well, and so some of this push is going to be, you know, getting your buddy to check your back and so forth and so on, but because there are parts that you can't see, so that a medical provider doing a thorough annual mole check is important. And what I try to remind my patients is that your skin is an organ, because patients will say to me, well, that part isn't sun exposed, because I do see quite a bit of vulvar skin dysplasia. And patients are always quite surprised to realize that our cumulative sun exposure can actually affect our non-sun exposed parts of our body as well. A little depressing,
really?
I know. And plus, many of us do wear clothes that aren't sun repellent. There are some that are more effective at being sun repellent. So I think that our listeners will hear a lot more about these SSEs, self skin examination.
So here, obviously, what we're concerned about is skin cancer. And that, again, it's the kind of thing where if you should be on the lookout for things. And then if there's something that you're concerned about, then you need to go to your, whether it's a primary care doctor, you know, whatever,
right,
and get them to take a look at it and see, is it okay?
Right.
What are the basic things that we say people should look for?
Something that's new, something that has changed in color, something that's fairly large, though they talk about over 6 millimeters. So, you know, definitely something that's bigger than like a half an inch. That's huge in mole terms. And we think that things that aren't uniform in their look, so something that's mottled, either irregular borders or irregular coloration to it, those are the general things they're looking for. And as I surfed around, I realized that there are just tons of good websites with pictures. I don't really encourage people to self-diagnose, but if you want to compare your little spot to a picture, it is somewhat useful to get a clue. But really, just getting that spot check done once a year is probably going to be an important strategy as doing your pap smear every year.
And whenever we have the dermatologists on the show, we always talk about this, but their recommendation is that people wear sunscreen and that they wear it even in the winter time, and that otherwise you need to do what you can to limit your sun exposure. If you're going to be outside, make sure you wear sunscreen. If you're really going to be outside for a long time, maybe you want to think about getting yourself a hat with a big brim, or maybe,
right,
even, as you say, some of the kind of clothing that has has some screening. I don't know if it's something that they rinse the material in or has something to do with the material, but there are clothes that you can wear
Absolutely.
That will cut down on your...
And it has something to do with the weave as well, so yeah. that is also very important.
Because regular, just regular, say like a regular cotton T-shirt, I think it's almost no better than if you weren't wearing any T-shirt
I
at
know.
All.
Absolutely. And people forget. They think that if I'm in my car that I'm not getting sun exposure, and there's quite a bit of UV penetration even through glass.
Yeah, particularly on that one. If you're driving, it's on that
right.
one side.
And they're coming out with, there's going to be a pill that you can take, I think it's available already by prescription, that you can take when you are on vacation and out in sun that cuts down on your amount of burning. Because burning, that's even a different deal altogether. Everybody yeah. knows we're not supposed to burn. The problem with the pill is it's got about a two-hour half-life. And so you're going to need to retake it all day long if you're really going to be out in the sun for a long period of time. But still, for a tennis game or something, I can't
is that
last
better
a whole
than,
2 hours.
Better than sunscreen?
Well, I think it's going to be part and parcel, and it's new. And there are new sunscreens finally available. Neutrogena's come out with a prescription strength sunscreen with the new ingredients that have only been available in Canada and Europe.
Okay. Well, anything else real quick that you want to do?
Let's see. I was... going to talk about the uterine. I thought for sure someone would call me about uterine transplants because it's been all over the news. And yes, they are going to move forward finally and work on uterine transplants as a possibility. They think that this might be something that if somebody did not have a uterus, they could, if they were planning a pregnancy relatively soon, they could get a uterine transplant, get their pregnancy, and then organ rejection would not be such a problem if they thought they might not be able to not reject the organ for years and years and years. And I think they're first looking for participants. It's going to be a study conducted in New York, but I don't know that it would really be something that we could access here unless there's an internet listener out there somewhere. But it's kind of exciting. It's new.
Well, there we'll leave it for this time around with our thanks to our guest, Dr. Suzanne Tropin. She is an OBGYN. She has practice here in our area. She teaches at U of I Med School. Every other month she's here. We talk about women's health. Thank you.
Thanks. It's
World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 15 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions and requests always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. That's it for us on Focus. We want you to stay tuned. There's more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we're going to talk about India with journalist Edward Luce. He is the author of In Spite of the Gods, The Strange Rise of Modern India. He'll join us at 1:06. Ed Luce served as the Financial Times South Asia Bureau Chief and was based in New Delhi from 2001 to 2006. Again, he'll be our guest following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at commodity prices. Kansas March wheat trading at 488, down 1.25. In Chicago, March wheat 466.5, down 1/2. May 479, down 1. March corn 404.75, down 2. May 415.75, down 2.25. July 421.75, down 2.5. September 405, up.